Hello and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest for November 27th, 2019, the Good Order and Discipline edition. I am David Plotz of Atlas Obscura. I'm in Washington, D.C. Joining me from New Haven, from the campus of Yale University, where she is associated with it in some fashion, which I can never remember, and the New York Times Magazine also, but she is not at the New York Times Magazine, Emily Bazelon. Hello, Emily.
Hello. That was like more detail and introducing unnecessary uncertainty into my world.
It was. It was also ungrammatical, too. And then John Dickerson is off again this week. I don't even know why. Maybe he's finishing his book. That's okay. Gabfest stalwart Jamel Bowie, New York Times columnist Jamel Bowie, joins us from Charlottesville, probably. Hi, Jamel.
Hello.
And we are taping on Tuesday, so we're a little bit before Thanksgiving. So you're getting a slightly early Gabfest this week. On today's show, what is going on in the Navy? We'll talk about the Gallagher case and the naval secretary being made to walk the plank. I guess that's the right metaphor, if it's the Navy being made to walk the plank. Then impeachment takes a breath, kind of, after a wild couple of weeks. Where do we stand? What is about to happen? Is there more room to build a stronger case against the president? And then Thanksgiving is here. Thanksgiving, of course, is a holiday manufactured in part by President Abraham Lincoln. What holidays can we manufacture? We are going to adjust the calendar. We're going to fill out the roster. We're going to find new holidays that we should be celebrating rather than the ones that we do celebrate to go along with our Thanksgiving. Plus, we will have cocktail chatter. It is very hard to figure out what's been going on over at the Navy, and particularly over at SEAL HQ. But the gist of it seems to be that Chief Edward Gallagher, credibly accused of war crimes and convicted of one count of criminal activity where he posed with the corpse of an enemy, will remain a SEAL and will certainly remain a hero on Fox News. And the Secretary of the Navy, Richard Spencer, is out of a job. The Gallagher affair has introduced to us to a new and disturbing twist in President Trump's dance macabre with the U.S. government, having corrupted the Justice Department, corrupted the intelligence agencies, gutted the EPA, libeled the State Department. He now is choosing to impose his will in disturbing ways on the military. So, Jamel, you are a Navy brat. You're a child of the Navy. Was this the president? You're used to the commander-in-chief having authority over your parents, I suppose, as Navy service personnel. Was this the president just exercising his privileges due to him as commander-in-chief, or is there something more sinister here?
It's a little tough to say, right, as far as the president's privileges as commander-in-chief. It's certainly the case that President Trump has the authority to, say, reverse a demotion. But also part of being commander-in-chief is recognizing good military discipline, military order, acknowledging and recognizing the chain of command and the military process for dealing with soldiers who have broken laws, both of war and otherwise. And so even if it may be broadly within the president's authority, it still is extremely troubling, right, that the president would take a case of a soldier credibly accused of war crimes, of killing civilians, whose own fellow men testified against him, testified that they took steps to try to keep him from killing civilians, and that this soldier, you know, is disciplined by his commanding officers on the basis of strong evidence. And then the president reverses that, not because he has any particular reason to think that that everyone involved in this particular soldier's case was wrong, but because he seems to just think war crimes are good. And that's, you know, it's not illegal, but it's like unethical and troubling and kind of runs contrary to the spirit of the whole thing.
Emily, the president has now pardoned four people accused, credibly accused, or convicted of war crimes, including war crimes at the highest order of murdering innocents. His defense or the president's claim is, oh, they're killing machines, let them kill. Or today he seems to have said something about how he was protecting warriors. He's protecting our warriors. What's wrong with that theory of the case, that these are in fact soldiers who are there to kill, and if they go a little bit far in the performance of their duties, that's better than the alternative?
I mean, I don't think we're talking about going a little too far. These are either accusations or convictions about killings that took place off the battlefield. And to state the very obvious, the law of war internationally deeply prohibits those killings and that kind of violence because it's so important to be able to set limits. Certainly when our soldiers are at risk and in a vulnerable position but not actually in combat, we would expect other countries and other forces to treat them as prisoners of war or certainly as people who are protected from random, really random kinds of killings. It should be, I think it's pretty terrifying, not only in terms of the message it sends about America's values, although that is also terrifying, but also in terms of our own service members abroad. If you're worried about the brutal conduct of other people, then you want to be setting a different kind of example and sticking really closely to the international rules. You know, one of the reasons I say that is that it's people in the military are so deeply concerned about the message this is sending. It's very much in line, you know, with how kind of Trump sees the world, America first, this like brutal, you know, Hobbesian vision. But I think for people who actually have to serve, this feels dangerous.
Right. I mean, I think that where that falls down is that if you look historically, one of the great strengths of the United States, even though we fail to live up to it a lot of the time, even though we're terrible hypocrites, is our pretense that we are holding ourselves to a higher standard and our effort to hold ourselves to a higher standard. And often we did a better job than those of our opponents. And that gave us an enormous amount of soft power in the world. It made us trusted and welcomed in places, not everywhere and not at all times, but in disproportionately we were trusted and welcomed and thought to be able to be, you know, a useful intermediary, a useful hold keeper of the peace. It made it much easier for us to win in the market and to win in peace. And if you think of probably the most important victory of the past century for the United States, it was to keep a Europe that has been at peace and is essentially allied with the United States and become more or less a single market until recently. And then to oversee the collapse of an enemy in the Soviet Union that was at its doorstep. And that was won. First, it was won on the battlefield, but it was won by the kind of morality of the United States and our willingness to hold ourselves to a slightly higher standard some more of the time than other people were. And it's going to we will pay the price on this, if not today, then one day. Jamil, I want to go back to the point you hit on, which is that one of the things that's so noxious about this case and the case of Gallagher and then a case of some of the other people that Trump has pardoned is that it is the fellow service people who are reporting and testifying against them. It is the military itself is filled with people who know that holding themselves to a higher standard is critical for discipline, for legitimacy. And what is that going to do to how these services operate if that is no longer the case?
The vast majority of soldiers and officers are probably going to behave as they've always behaved. But the problem's never really been the vast majority, right? It's that a good analogy, maybe not a good analogy, but the analogy that comes to mind for me are police officers and cops. That part of the problem with the lack of discipline for bad cops is not that every single cop is going to suddenly become like a killer cop, but that the minority of cops who may have an inclination suddenly have a permission structure for doing it. And I think with soldiers likewise, the vast majority of soldiers and officers are not suddenly going to become war criminals. But the small minority who have an inclination towards extreme violence, towards unaccountable violence, all of a sudden now have a permission structure. The president of the United States has essentially said that if you do these things, I will pardon you because I do not think they are actually crimes. And given that U.S. troops are still deployed around the world, given that they're still in combat situations, it certainly does seem like if this minority of soldiers picks up on that message, there may just be more incidents like the ones committed by someone like Gallagher.
And then the other thing is that for the people who did come forward and broke the code of silence, which is an important component of being in a unit like the SEALs, no one has their back. Like, it's the opposite message.
Right.
It's that you're going to get, right? And, like, that's also means that we should expect to have less reporting. I mean, imagine how those soldiers feel. Like, that to me seems like a terrible position to be in.
Right, their colleague. I mean, they know that their colleague, they saw him shoot unarmed civilians. One report says that they intentionally messed with the scope on a sniper rifle so that if he attempted to shoot someone, he would not be able to aim properly. And so they know this guy is not well, and they've all just testified against him in the expectation that he would be disciplined and removed from active duty. And I don't know, I would feel really nervous about the fact that I just tried to basically, like, you know, have the state take this man's freedom away for good reasons, and he's just been pardoned and is suddenly been empowered for his actions. It would disturb me and make me worry a little bit.
Emily, what do you make of the foo-foo-rah about why the Secretary of the Navy, Spencer, was fired? Because I think Spencer's view is that he was essentially fired for attempting to maintain good order and discipline and maintain the integrity of the process, or mostly maintain the integrity of the process around Gallagher and Gallagher's punishment. And the White House's claim, or the Secretary of Defense's claim, is no, that he was cashiered because he was trying to make a secret deal with the White House, and that was the problem. Does it matter what the real reason is? I mean, does it matter? Yeah.
I think it matters. I mean, it seems like those things could both be true, right? That the Secretary of the Navy was trying to stick up for the rules, but also realized he was in this very difficult position and so was trying to come to some sort of deal. I mean, the deal could be bad because if you think that Gallagher should have lost his trident, and that's a really important message to send, then you don't want any kind of deal, and maybe even entertaining the notion was a bad idea. But the idea that the official who's, like, stuck in the middle would try to work something out doesn't seem at all surprising. The notion that that's why the White House and the, you know, Trump's defense secretary wanted to get rid of him, that doesn't seem very plausible. Like, he wasn't doing what they wanted. He wasn't simply rolling over. And it is also true that Trump's the commander-in-chief, so he had the authority to make this call.
One of the things that is so disturbing about these particular pardons, but in particular the case of Gallagher, is that it's clearly kind of a corrupt inside game. This combination of Fox plus connected lawyers got Gallagher the pardon that he wanted. Clearly, if you have a problem these days, and it's something that the president might be able to help with. You hire yourself a Trump crony or get yourself booked on Fox and Friends or some Fox show that you know the president wants. And I mean, I don't, this isn't really a question, Jamel, but like, what are we supposed to do about this? This is just, it's this way in which there's this completely shadow parallel set of corrupt activities that can go on simply by cozying up with Bernie Kerik and a Mukasey, and then you're okay.
Yeah, I have no idea. I mean, I think this is sort of low-key the problem of American politics right now. Not just that there's like this shadow network of lawyers and whomever who can help you get off, but also this sort of shadow information system that is a completely closed system, right? That it's entirely possible to wake up listening to Rush, Limbaugh, you know, make your breakfast watching Fox and Friends, listen to Hannity. I mean, you can kind of go through your entire day completely ensconced in an entirely parallel information network where someone like Gallagher is, in fact, a hero who's being persecuted by politically correct, you know, liberals in the deep state. And it's continuously reinforced by voices and people that you trust. And in the particular moment, it's sort of one of the participants in this as someone taking in the information. It's the president of the United States who then recapitulates it in public statements, thus strengthening the feedback loop. It's very I've used the word a couple times now, but it's very troubling, to put it lightly. And I'm not really sure how one deals with it.
Emily, do you know how to deal with it?
No, I don't know how to deal with it. And you know, like, this is the reality we live in. The country continues along. We're all going to have Thanksgiving this week. And yet, like, it's deeply disturbing. And, like, this parallel reality that is not okay.
Have you guys looked at the list of people Trump has pardoned? That was a kind of a sidebar for this. The list of people Trump has pardoned is so appalling. It's like Sheriff Joe Arpaio, Dinesh D'Souza, war criminals, Conrad Black, some corrupt Republican politician from California. It's just a very embarrassing list. Not to say that, you know, some of these people, you know, the president should exercise his power of pardon. It's a great power to have, but that he exercises it so politically and for such extremely scummy people, and not for the millions of people who probably deserve it, is very demoralizing. Jamel, I'll leave you the last word on this. Do you think this story has any political legs? Is this a story which because it has to do with the military, it causes any loss of prestige for Trump with people who support the military, or no? Because it actually seems like, oh, he's standing up for warrior culture, and that will generally halo him.
On one hand, I think there's a Daily Beast report. The Daily Beast had a report that Trump may be considering bringing Gallagher on the campaign trail with him next year. So if that happens, I think there might be a good case you could make that this could hurt the president, because you would suddenly have at least the media and Democrats making the point that Gallagher is an accused war criminal, and you'd have details about what he did in the public eye again, and that could like move public opinion. On the other hand, A, there's the closed information system, which means that the president's supporters are not going to be budged by any of this. There's the fact that within the military, there's a distinct public opinion split between enlisted service members and officers. Enlisted service members are much more friendly towards Trump than officers are. It kind of mirrors the college-educated, non-college-educated split in the larger electorate. And so this is the kind of thing which may even improve the president's standing with enlisted service members, while further sort of deepening his hole with officers. Basically, the split between people who may sort of be really committed to a warrior culture and people who value the professionalism of the United States military. But it's sort of hard to untangle what the political impact of this would be in an election year. It may end up not mattering at all, right? That opinions on Trump are just so polarized at this point that this will just be further fodder for people who don't like him and will support their view, and for people who think he's the bee's knees.
I'm just going to make one final point, which is that, you know, one of the things that Gallagher had in his favor is that he's like what you imagine Trump thinks a soldier looks like.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Like a square-jawed white dude. And if Gallagher were a black guy or Latino, no chance any of this happens. None. It's
maybe if he were, you know, a black
Trump,
guy.
Trump.
I think, actually. Just as sort of
no.
Yeah, maybe.
Wait, what's Jamel's theory of the case?
What's your theory?
Say more.
My theory here is that Trump does like to show off black people who he helps.
Yeah, it's true. Amorosa.
So I could if it were like a Denzel Washington looking dude, you know, square jawed, you know, spitting image of military with the military likes to project itself, maybe. If it were a woman, absolutely not.
Hmm. Well, it's all,
yeah,
it's all counterfactual. I don't, but we'll see. Let's look at what other war criminals he's going to pardon in the coming year or so. GabFest listeners, remember, we have our live conundrum show coming up at the Fox Theater in Oakland on December 18th. That's just 3 weeks away, 2.5 weeks away. Adam Savage of Mythbusters is going to join us to solve conundra of all sorts and kinds. And it's going to be really fun. That show is a joyful show, and Adam Savage is so funny and interesting and smart. So you should join us there. Go to slate.com/live to get tickets. And if you want, send us a conundrum yourself. Tweet to us at SlateGabFest with hashtag conundrum, or go to slate.com/conundrum and fill out our form there. So slate.com/live for tickets on December 18th. This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024 The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
Emily, impeachment had a hot and heavy couple of weeks. Now it is stopping for Thanksgiving, sort of. It seems as though after the holiday, Adam Schiff's committee will file a report to the House Judiciary Committee, and that will be the next step in the impeachment process. I'm an easily confused person, so it is not surprising that I find myself flummoxed by all the various things that are happening. But there seem to be, as we take a break from the hearing, so many different threads happening, so many different kind of corrupt conspiracies, all of which were aimed at trying to implicate Joe Biden, trying to get to tar Joe Biden. But you had a lot of Giuliani this week, Giuliani pressuring two Ukrainian oligarchs under U.S. Who are themselves under threat from the U.S. Department of Justice, and Giuliani seemingly trying to get them to do his sinister Biden bidding by offering them a relief from DOJ prosecution. You had Devin Nunes colluding with Giuliani sidekicks. You had another FBI investigation or DOJ investigation of Giuliani about perhaps him channeling foreign money into a PAC. It's just like a lot of stuff going on. It's very confusing. Can you just maybe give the summarize what's interesting or what's important or all this chaff? What do we need to focus on?
I mean, I think the chaff that's important is what we can prove about what Giuliani and Nunes were doing involving the Ukraine and like how much they were directly involved or just ginning up false evidence against the Bidens in an effort to help Trump and affect the 2020 election. That all seems pretty important. You know, Nunes is like talking about suing CNN for libel based on its reporting. On the other hand, he won't answer a direct question about whether he met with the Ukrainian former prosecutor who's at the center of the accusations. So, you know, be good to know whether Devin Nunes, arch Trump defender, member of the House committee that is doing this whole impeachment inquiry, whether he was himself directly caught up. I'm interested in that question.
But that's all you've fallen into the trap, Emily. You're very in the
What did you want me to do?
Well, no, I want
I was supposed come to out take of these, a step back.
A step back. We've come out of these weeks of hearings. We've heard from all these people, but you know, then we haven't heard from other people. And then there's a lot of stuff going on around Giuliani and Trump's taxes, and will Don McGahn have to testify? And it's just it's like you're being poked in the head and also being tickled on the feet. And also, you know, and also someone has stuck a red hot poker in your eye. Like all different things are happening at once. And how do we focus on what we really need to focus on? What is it? Or Jamel, well, what is it that we need to focus on?
I think you should call it Jamel, though I do have thoughts about the legal proceedings. But let's give Jamel a crack since I failed.
So my hot take is you don't need to focus on anything. I think that the best bet going forward is to throw everything at the wall, to investigate, to, you know, subpoena everyone who might have any information on the president's scandals, to hear from everyone, to kind of draw these proceedings out. I personally understand that House Democrats don't want this to appear partisan, but the fact of the matter is it is partisan. And I don't quite understand the strategy behind narrowly focusing on one thing and leaving the rest of it kind of to, you know, float away to drive towards a speedy trial. I think that smarter play, knowing that, and I think I said this on Twitter recently, that in just 6 weeks, we've gotten definitive evidence that the president tried to tamper in elections to secure his reelection by having a foreign power, a foreign country, sort of run a sham investigation of an opponent, right? Like 6 weeks, we have definitive proof. So knowing what we know about the Trump administration thus far, knowing that there's almost certainly other shady stuff, just go for broke and keep the investigation going as long as possible. If nothing else, we kind of know from the past that Trump does worse in the public when he's sort of in a maelstrom of scandal. And there's the immediate instrumental advantage of keeping a trial out of Mitch McConnell's hands for as long as possible, keeping this thing going so that by the time it does go to the Senate, it might be summer 2020, it might be fall 2020, there simply won't be enough time for a McConnell-led Senate to turn this into an attempt to investigate Biden, which is what Republicans in the Senate are already signaling they plan to do.
Right. So Jamel,
to play the like Nancy Pelosi card, at least I think, and not that I've spoken to her recently or ever. What about the what about the supposed political cost of the country just getting tired of this, feeling like it's distracting? What are you doing about my health care, my other complaints about the federal government, like that whole notion that this matters to people in Washington, it makes for great TV, but it doesn't help voters in their everyday lives.
So I think I'm going to go for the non-pejorative version of what I think about that argument, which is that I think it's extremely condescending of voters across the country. The American public can care about multiple things at once. The American public isn't sort of monomaniacally focused on its pocketbook. It's clear from the 2018 midterm elections that the thing driving the energy for the Democratic Party wasn't some belief that Democrats are going to immediately solve all the problems that voters may face, but anti-Trump energy, a belief that there's something deeply wrong in the country and this is the best avenue to do something about it. Anti-Trump energy is, if Democrats are positioned to win the election next year at all, that is the proximate cause. It seems to me that the smart political play is to actually continue to gin up anti-Trump energy, to lean into the fact that that is where the wins for your sales are coming from. And this idea that, in fact, responding to the public's desire to see the president be held accountable is somehow sort of not the business of elected representatives. It's just insane to me. It's an insane thing to believe. I don't know. I tend to think that Pelosi's vaunted capacity for political strategy is like way overstated. And I think that this is a clear case of her hand essentially being forced into impeachment, that impeachment being a clear political benefit for Democrats so far, and that her and her team still basically being extreme worry words about what's going to happen next.
Wait, so Jamel, just to belabor this point, what is your case that the longer this goes on and the more threads there are, that the American public has more anti-Trump energy as opposed to exhaustion? Is there polling evidence of that? I don't have a position one way or another, but it seems like you'd want to know. From a numerical perspective, does this actually make sense?
Right. So far, there's no particular evidence that the public's gotten exhausted. If anything, I think what the polling shows, and the polling's been pretty stable, is that impeachment does better the more that there seems to be sort of like real serious revelations. And that's sort of the heart of my case, is that we know there's probably going to be others. If this does appear just to be a fishing expedition, maybe it hurts. Although I think the example of Benghazi and the Republican investigation suggests perhaps otherwise. But let's say it's the case of the fishing expedition does not help, then sure. But if there are regular revelations, if the public is getting regular news about what's happening in the administration, I think that that helps. And I think that that keeps support for impeachment at least at its current level and may even increase it. And this is just sort of like not a database case or quantitative case, but just a sense about how public opinion and how the response to the president has been. We kind of know over the past 3 years that when Trump is faced, let me say this in reverse, when things are quiet for Trump, he does well. His approval rating ticks up. The public kind of gets habituated to him because external conditions are basically fine, right? Sort of the economy is growing. We're fighting a bunch of wars, but the public isn't really thinking about them. There's no sense of sort of extreme dysfunction. It's only when there's a sense of extreme dysfunction that Trump really starts to suffer. And part of what creates the sense of extreme dysfunction is the fact that Trump cannot handle serious scrutiny, that when faced with scrutiny, he begins to sort of self-destruct. And so part of my case for just continuing this thing is that the more pressure the White House faces, the more revelations come out, the more likely it is that Trump basically begins to melt down. And it's that melting down which bolsters the Democratic case for switching horses midstream and returning to a sense of normalcy.
That's interesting. I mean, what's interesting about that, Jamel, is it makes a different case about timing. I mean, the assumption has been, looking at the legal proceedings, that the Democrats can't afford to wait for the courts to referee their subpoena requests. And that's been based on the past administration's experiences, both the George W. Bush and Obama administrations. Congress had these subpoenas that, like, went on forever in the courts and were unsatisfactorily resolved, even though Congress didn't outright lose. So this week, we got a ruling from the district court, federal district court judge in Washington, Ketanji Brown Jackson. And what Judge Jackson said was that this initial very extreme position that the White House took, that McGahn has absolute immunity from testifying, is ridiculous. And, like, this is pretty obvious as a matter of law. And Judge Jackson wrote what sounds like a super solid 120-page opinion knocking it down. But, of course, now this case has to be appealed and go up the chain. And then when it comes back, even if the ruling is affirmed, then there'll be all these questions about whether McGahn has to answer specific questions or not. Like, that's the real legal issue here. So that's going to take a while. Then, meanwhile, we have the Supreme Court staying an order by the lower courts that Trump's tax returns should get turned over. There are two cases about this. One is about whether Congress has the right to these tax returns. The other is about the district attorney, Cy Vance, in Manhattan. Trump doesn't have a particularly strong legal position in either of those cases. But if the Supreme Court weighs in, we could wind up with a major ruling. And it's not clear what the conservative majority on the Supreme Court is going to have to say about executive power. There are some justices who are extremely pro-executive power. We could be talking about setting some really bad precedents here. There's nothing Congress can really do about that, since the subpoena case has already been set in motion and the other one doesn't involve Congress at all. But one thing listening to you make that strong case for letting these proceedings play out is that maybe the delay in the legal proceedings actually just, like, runs on a parallel track. And the only witness for whom this, like, matters really is maybe John Bolton. I mean, he has been doing this weird dance where he sort of dangles the idea that he has information, but he wants a judge's order that he's allowed to testify. Well, just Judge Brown actually gave that order. She said that her order would apply even if there were national security concerns. So if he just wants a fig leaf of a judicial order or just, like, that backup to obey Congress's subpoena, well, like, he could testify any day now.
I wonder if there's going to Jamel's impeachment now, impeachment forever, impeachment everywhere. I wonder if there's actually an interesting thing for Democrats to try to do, which is that it's now clear that these public servants, that these mid-level officials who are mostly career professional officials can testify, and that they've done it, and they've done it bravely and very convincingly in a way that has been very impressive. And I wonder if there are other scandalous things that have happened in the Trump administration, even things that we've forgotten, but which are hugely corrupt, involving Saudi Arabia or, you know, who knows what else, China, that there are bureaucrats and mid-level appointees waiting to testify, and you just have to identify them and get hearings that are based on that rather than trying, because they're never going to get the Trump officials themselves. You're never going to get Don McGahn to say anything interesting for the most part. But there may be other people hidden in the bowels of the deep state ready to have their revenge and do the deep state coup that everyone's talking about.
I wouldn't describe it as a deep state coup, but I think that's right, right? Like, if you look at, you know, one area that I would love to see Democrats really investigate and throw their resources behind, it's just, what is the nature of the president's relationship with the leadership in Saudi Arabia and the leadership in Turkey? That clearly something strange is happening there, and that I think the public would gain a lot from a deep investigation of it. And if there are things happening, as if there's serious corruption there, and I think there's You know, judging from...
I will eat my shoe if there's not serious corruption in those countries.
I was trying to find a way to like be, you know, measured about this. But yeah, absolutely. Like, it's obvious that there's something extremely corrupt happening in both cases. And if the Ukraine thing is any indication, there are probably mid-level bureaucrats, ordinary civil servants, who know something. Now maybe have an opportunity to talk if Democrats investigate. Earlier in the conversation, we were talking about Gallagher. I said that for sort of part of the problem with pardoning war criminals or restoring them to rank is that it creates a permission structure for bad behavior. Democrats can create a permission structure for good behavior, for whistleblowing, for helping, for encouraging these bureaucrats and people who are dedicated just to the work of furthering the interests of the United States government to speak in public and to say what they've seen and to say what they think if they think something is going wrong. And I think that would be valuable in its own right. And again, as we've seen with the president's response to similar testimony over the past 2 weeks, neither the president nor his allies are going to be able to say anything. They have no real defense. The only defense they have is the hope that this fades from public view. So let's just not let that happen.
Slate Plus members get bonus segments on this, the Gabfest, and on other Slate podcasts. And if you go to slate.com/GabFestPlus, you can become a member today. And today, we're going to talk about what is the idea, the concept, the theory that we learned in school, in college, that influenced us the most and still influences us. What is it that we actually learned that you still take with you every day to work, Emily Bazelon and Jamelle Bouie? So go to slate.com/GabFestPlus to become a member today and listen to that bonus segment.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest, biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-hosts cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.
If you want to understand what is happening in the United States right now, you really need to understand what's happening with the courts, the law, and the Supreme Court. The battle between democracy and whatever this cage match is that we're witnessing, it's going to be won and lost at the ballot box, but it's also going to be won and lost in the courtrooms. I'm Dahlia Lithwick. I host Slate's legal podcast, Amicus, and we are doubling our output, bringing you weekly episodes from here on in, because how else can we keep an eye on the many trials of Donald Trump, the conservative legal movement's assaults on our rights, the Supreme Court's latest slate of environmental gutting, gun safety eviscerating cases on the docket? So follow Amicus wherever you get your podcasts, new episodes dropping every Saturday morning.
Abraham Lincoln effectively created Thanksgiving as a national holiday. It had a kind of previous existence. He calcified it on the calendar as the fourth Thursday in November. I didn't realize the history. Like, it actually has some Gettysburg-y kind of celebration quality to it. He announced it in October of 1863. It seems to have been associated with some sort of celebration of Gettysburg. And so that was what put Thanksgiving on the calendar. FDR moved it around a little bit, but it's remained. It's a manufactured holiday. It's a holiday that has been given a great history, and now is, as we've discussed, Emily and I have certainly discussed many, many times, it's certainly my favorite holiday, and it's the best American holiday in my view. And because it's Thanksgiving week and we don't have a lot of time, and you guys don't want to hear some more heavy duty political discussion on a week like this, you're cooking your mashed potatoes. We thought we would do a third segment that was a little bit more speculative about how to remake the calendar. What new holidays America needs? What is it that we could add to the holiday calendar? And maybe what should we subtract from the holiday calendar that would make us all excited, that would make people find a new celebration that would bring them joy. So we can do this roundtable, or we can just sort of start talking. I have a couple of ideas, but Emily, a lady's choice. Go ahead. What do you want to add or subtract?
Okay. Well, so my first thought about this, and I am now channeling my son Simon, is that we should have a federal holiday once a month so that there is a 3-day weekend once a month. And we already have some of the months covered, but not all of them. Now, I don't mean in suggesting this that there should be less school. I think we should add days to the school calendar if that's necessary, though I don't have a strong position on how many total days there should be. I do think the length of the summer in places that have like the long 2.5-3 month summer is has been shown to just be like bad for kids learning overall, especially low-income kids who don't have lots of great summer opportunities. I do think, though, that the three-day weekend once a month would just be great as a break, and that we should try to really like do a better job of protecting it as a real break.
Okay, can I argue with you about not that it's not a good idea? It's a good idea. I think what I find interesting about the holidays that matter is that they actually come. They have logic behind them. They have history. They have tradition. They have feeling behind them. And so yes. Oh yeah, we'll have a 3-day weekend. But to me, what would make it valuable is if you say this 3-day weekend is to say it's Labor Day or it is. One holiday. It's National Park Day. It's National Park Weekend. So this is the 3-day weekend. This is the holiday which honors National Parks. So a lot of people will be like, go to National Parks. There's free admission at National Parks or whatever.
I love that idea.
Give it some structure, some identity,
some symbolism. Yeah, I totally agree. I agree. I don't think
not just like 3-day weekends, like, oh yeah, Friday's off or Monday's off.
Like the Washington Lincoln birthday weekend is the vaguest maybe in the calendar, or Veterans Day, which hasn't really like, I don't know. Yes, I agree. I think that's true. I mean, one obvious day to add is voting day. National celebrate voting. Actually vote on that day. Make it so that it's easier for people to vote. And we're really honoring that as a civic holiday.
Election day.
Jamel. Thoughts.
I'm 100% pro holiday. I think people should work less. I think there should be 4-day work weeks. What's the use in living in a rich country if people can't take time off? I have like a whole list of holidays I'd like to see, and I agree with David that it does help if they're historically resonant, that they have some greater symbolic value. And so I've for years thought that, right, that Juneteenth should be a national holiday. Everyone gets the day off, and you can kind of make it sort of a national emancipation day for celebrating the end of slavery. I think that would be really great.
Yep, I'm in.
There's a Susan B. Anthony Day in February. So why not like try to make some day in the year be basically a suffrage day, like in celebration of women's suffrage. Everyone gets a day off to celebrate the advance of democracy. And maybe that's sort of like the template. Like we declare days off for events that represent like the broadening of American democracy. That way they're nice and inclusive and everyone can feel good about them.
Ooh, you've given me an idea. 14th Amendment Day.
Oh, hell yeah.
That's like such an important Reconstruction Amendment, right? It would be a way of both celebrating Reconstruction and looking at the expansion of our rights to liberty, to due process, et cetera.
You guys, just not to be
we've
cold water.
You've added
Juneteenth, the 14th Amendment, Susan B. Anthony Day. That's like there's a little overlap.
We revealed our identities.
You can have two.
We can get proud.
Two of those, but not three. Go form a committee.
And
get two. I think midsummer should be a holiday. So I think that day. I think the June 21st, because it's the longest day of the year. It's like, especially when you're far north, it's just so lovely to have that long day. And it should be a day of picnic, a day of parties. Kids should get to stay up all night that night. I think that would be a great tradition. You have that in Scandinavian countries, and people are really moved by it. And I think we should adopt a piece of that. And I think there should be some science-y day, but I don't know what it would be, like the moon landing. I'm not sure. I definitely think National Parks Day. There should be a National Parks Day or Parks Day.
I think that's a really good idea too.
Yeah, include the state parks. State parks are awesome.
Definitely Election Day.
I kind of want there to be Game Day, like you know that Jewish holiday Lag BaOmer, where it's like the end of the counting of the Omer, which is just like some number of days that's passed. Uh-huh. Anyway, the end of it is like games, right? That was always the fun day at Hebrew school when you got to go outside and play games. I like the idea of like capture the flag and hide and go seek for adults, for everybody. Mm. Escape rooms could have a really busy agenda on that day.
All right.
I'm all about more civically themed holidays, so there should be a ratification day to celebrate the ratification of the Constitution, which is just as important as its actual writing.
That's good. All right. That seems good.
That's a good one. Yeah. So could we combine that with July 4th? Or the Constitution needs its own separate day from the Declaration of Independence.
Own when separate was the day. Declaration gets its own day.
What is it?
It was June 21st, 1788.
Is that when a certain number of states had done it? That's midsummer.
Yeah, it's midsummer.
It's midsummer day. Perfect.
So we can have ratification and midsummer. Those are kind of not that aligned, I would say, those two impulses. Yeah. Let's stay up all night and like have the sort of chaos of midsummer and also think seriously about the glory of ratification.
Yeah. All right. Well, we're just getting started.
I mean, I would do things like make Labor Day more of like an explicit sort of like militant labor holiday, but
yeah, labor history.
Right.
Really? Would that be fun?
Yeah.
What would people like? Why would they enjoy that?
I don't know. I would enjoy it.
They'd learn stuff.
But people don't use holidays to learn things. They use holidays to gather or to have activity. Holidays are not an occasion for knowledge. They're an occasion for communality and joy and release. So I don't think...
I don't know.
Doesn't mean we can't use them to instill good Republican values.
Yeah, we always watch MLK's I Have a Dream speech on MLK Day.
Do you really?
Yeah.
That's nice. You're good. What a good person you are. All right, GabFest listeners, if you have ideas for great new holidays, please send them to us at tweet them to us at @GabFest or go to the Facebook page, facebook.com/GabFest, and give us some ideas there. Let's go to cocktail chatter. So when you are having your pumpkin spice martini, Emily, over Thanksgiving, what are you going to be chattering about?
I read such an interesting article about Joe Biden this week. We didn't talk about the Democrats. I was happy to have a break from them. But this article in The Atlantic about Biden as a stutterer, the thesis being that he is still suffering in some way from a fear of stuttering and that this is partly explains his gaffes in talking. I don't think it fixes all of them, but it does get to some of them. It really made me have a lot more sympathy for Joe Biden and just a kind of explanation of what's going on. And the key thing about the piece is that it's by a guy named John Hendrickson, who is himself a stutterer, and the insight he brought and the kind of pathos of how the Biden campaign at first, like, ignored him, didn't want to grant him an interview, and then seems to have realized that it was probably in Biden's interest to have this angle explored more. It's really good. It's in The Atlantic in their January-February issue and also posted online.
Jamel, what are you going to chatter about?
This past Sunday's episode of HBO's Watchmen. HBO's Watchmen is a – it's not an adaptation. It's actually very strange what it is. It's sort of a in-universe sequel / remix of a 12-issue comic book series from the 80s by writer Alan Moore and artist Dave Gibbons called Watchmen. And Watchmen is sort of an important comic book series because it's like the seminal kind of deconstruction of comic books series that Alan Moore and Gibbons use sort of these – classic characters and archetypes to deconstruct the superhero genre, to think deeply about what these characters represent, to think deeply about the kind of world that would produce them, and kind of comment on America and the UK in the 1980s and sort of in a moment of turmoil and tension and inequality and so on and so forth. Really groundbreaking work, really important. And the HBO series is jumping off of that. And the first 5 episodes have kind of touched on some of those elements of the series, but have really been, I think, concerned with building an independent story. But this past 6th episode called This Extraordinary Being is a direct commentary in a lot of ways on the original comic series and recontextualizes a key part of that series in a way that I think completely makes you rethink what the show is doing and what the comic book was doing. And is a really just like fascinating piece of narrative storytelling in addition to being a very well-directed and well-performed piece of television. So I don't want to go into any more detail because I don't want to spoil things for people, but it was a remarkable episode of television. It sort of it's commenting on the current series, HBO's Watchmen, sort of interest in America's history of racial injustice. I was just blown away the first time I saw it. And I've watched that episode 3 times now, and each time find something new to glean from it. It's really a remarkable piece of television.
Can I skip ahead to this episode 6, which now I'm interested in, even if I've only seen the first couple episodes? Or is that a terrible idea?
It's really worth, like, watching the first 5 episodes. It's not so much that each episode is – episode 6 is narratively dependent on those previous episodes, but I think sort of fully being immersed in the world will help a lot. Like, you don't need to read the comics, the original comics, I think, for this, but it does, I think, help to have progressed through the series.
Wait, I have a second service question. I just started reading the book.
Yes.
Which I like. I like pretty much like it. I'm not a real comics person, but I'm liking it okay. Should I finish it before I watch the show?
If you're already reading it, why not?
Okay.
Yeah. The tricky thing is that the world of the comic book, like, if you've read it, there will be things you notice and, like, things you pick up on that are fun, but it's not really narratively critical. And even the 6th episode, which is, like, commenting directly on the comic book, is not necessarily narratively critical to read it, because the show does a good job of situating the key points, so you can just watch the show and get there. I think that the value of reading the comic book, if anything, is to just sort of, like, get yourself in the mindset of, like, what the Watchmen style is, which is sort of not just this, like, you know, story of superheroes, but sort of, like, very astute, like, meta commentary on lots of different things, and a visual style that is sort of very, very dense with detail. The thing I like about the comic quite a bit is that you could read it a dozen times, and just depending on how you look at the panels, how you focus on the panels, you'll notice different elements, different things, and that thing carries over to the series as well, I think.
All right, my chatter. So it's Thanksgiving, so I'd like to give thanks in my Thanksgiving chatter. And I had a really tough and heartbreaking year this year, and one way to get through hard times is through country music. And so I wanted to give thanks and recommendations to the women of country music who have been the soundtrack of my bad year. So I want to say happy Thanksgiving to Ashley Munro and Maren Morris and Brandi Carlile and Emmylou Harris and Jody Messina and Kacey Musgraves and Lucinda Williams and Iris DeMent and Loretta Lynn. I wish you many, many tears, ladies, in the coming year, so you'll have great new songs for me. So thank you for being so supportive of me in the past year, and may you have another miserable year. Listeners, you have given...
That was a good list. I like that list.
Yeah, well, there's plenty more on it. Plenty more on it. Mary Chapin Carpenter, Ashley McBride. I like Ashleys of all sorts. Dolly Parton, Patsy Cline.
I was thinking Dolly Parton was missing. I'm glad you threw her in there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Here You Come Again. That is a song that I really love. That is a great song. So, listeners, you again, as usual, outdid yourselves with your listener chatter. You've been tweeting them to us at Slate Gabfest. And again, like, let's do a jolly one, a jolly chatter from Rachel Johnston, PhD, at Rach M. Johnston. And she sends us a story about firefighters saving the day. And it's a story from, I think, a Chicago newspaper about a boy who was having a birthday party. I think he's a 7-year-old boy. And a lot of people said they were coming, and nobody showed up at the birthday party. And these firefighters who were down the street just heard about it. Someone mentioned it to them. And they showed up at this birthday party and had a birthday party with this boy. And it's just, it'll make you cry. I wept reading the story. Super cute story. So check it out. That is our GabFest for today. The show is produced by Jocelyn Frank. Our researcher is Bridget Dunlap. Ryan McAvoy helped out Emily at Yale. Rosemary Belson helped me out here in D.C. Gabriel Roth is editorial director of Slate Podcast. June Thomas is managing producer. You should follow us on Twitter at SlateGabFest and send chatter to us there, and send your conundrums to us there with a hashtag conundrum. And you should come to our conundrum show in Oakland, California on December 18th at the Fox Theater. Go to slate.com/live. There are still tickets there. for Emily Bazelon and Jamel Bowie. What are you guys going to eat? Jamel, what is your distinctive Thanksgiving food that you're going to eat on Thursday?
We're going to have collard greens and mac and cheese and stuffing. I think I'm excited to make. It's very simple, but just whole roasted carrots with garlic and dill.
Yum.
That sounds yummy.
And I have some other things on the menu. Going to bake a sweet potato pie, as always. Going to bake a salty honey pie, which my parents haven't had before, but I make every year. So it'll be good.
Wait, did you say salty honey?
Yes, it's a honey custard that I just finished with flaky sea salt.
Yes, I know a pie like that. That sounds delicious. That sounds really good. Emily,
I'll eat that.
What's the thing that you're going to eat that you're looking forward to?
I always make apple pie. That's my wholesome, basic contribution. I know it's not super exciting, but I'm not a big pie maker, so just my making pie at all makes my husband in particular happy.
You're a very good baker in general, in my experience.
But I'm not like a pie person, usually. Not like you.
But for me, although I'm not going to make any pies, I've got other duties, but it'll be my mother's mocha chocolate crunch pie. I strongly recommend. There's a recipe for it on Slate somewhere. It's the greatest dish anyone has ever made.
Super yummy.
It is unbelievably really good. So I hope you all have a wonderful Thanksgiving. Thank you for listening. We'll talk to you next week. Hello, Slate Plus. So Slate Plus today, why not talk about what we learned and what stuck with us? So I was thinking, I have a daughter who's in college and then a son in high school, another son in sixth grade. But I was talking to both my daughter and my middle son this week and just struck at them learning certain concepts or learning ideas that I remember learning myself or have already forgotten. And then you think back like, well, what did I learn? What did I ever learn in school anyway? And obviously you accrete all sorts of knowledge, but I was interested in sort of what the theories that stuck with you hardest, the things that you either use or like have become a defining metaphor for how you see the world or just for some reason were super vivid for you. And I wondered what that was for you guys. And I have three myself, but
I want you to start with this one.
I can start with I'll start with one of them. I think the one concept in biology or maybe evolutionary biology, I'm not sure what you call it, that has stuck with me is the idea of K strategies versus R strategies. Do you guys remember what that is?
No.
In reproduction. So a K strategy is a creature that has a few but very expensive offspring. So us, where you give your offspring a ton of care. You really are there. They gestate for a long time. You individuate them. You know, it's an elephant. It's a giraffe. It's us. An R strategy is where you just have like a gazillion offspring. Don't give them any care. Just toss them out. Your classic like fish, your fish strategy, your sea turtle strategy. It's like we're just going to have a ton of them. Maybe a few of them are going to survive. We're not going to really give them any care. And it's a very useful way of understanding biology, I suppose, and how certain creatures pursue different strategies. It's also really useful when you start to think about different ways of approaching problems in life. Like there's certain kinds of problems which you want to approach by giving it a huge amount of care and attention and time. And there are other problems which you're like, you know what? We'll just try a million different things. Some of them work, some of them won't. We won't invest too much energy in it and see what happens. And I find that a very useful metaphor a lot of the time.
That's fascinating.
Emily, what's something you've learned once?
Once. Sometimes I just feel overwhelmed by all the things I haven't learned, but I'm going to answer in the affirmative. So utilitarian theory occupies me a lot. I don't entirely subscribe to it, but I think about it as a template often for deciding how much I care about something. So Jeremy Bentham and Cesar Beccaria talking about the idea that you...
GabFest fans, that was just a teaser. To hear the rest of our Slate Plus conversation, go to slate.com/GabFestPlus to become a Slate Plus member today.